Hi, my name is Sam Becerra. I'm a professor of statistics at California State University, Fullerton. I received my PhD from Carnegie Mellon in 2003 under the supervision of Rob Cass, who's a professor of statistics and machine learning here at CMU. Today I'm speaking to Rob about a lecture he recently gave at CMU entitled Uncertainty, Information, and Narrative. So Rob, what motivated you to give this lecture?
Well, it started with the New York Times Sunday opinion pages, where we frequently find opinions from accomplished scientists who describe valuable scientific results and speculate about them in an interesting way, which is all great, except that too often they fail to distinguish results from speculation, and thereby grossly exaggerate their knowledge. My worry is that such accounts on balance tend to erode public confidence in science, partly because speculations are frequently proven wrong, but also because stories of this type do not do justice to the majesty, the beauty, and the effectiveness of the scientific enterprise. Instead, they trivialize it, reinforcing an unfortunate misimpression many people have about science because they don't appreciate how science makes progress in the face of uncertainty. And this isn't limited to journalistic accounts of science. A similar thing can happen in scientific papers as well. And it seems to me to be an especially acute problem in the top journals, where I often read articles having to do with the brain sciences. Like many other human endeavors, science is built on storytelling. The aim of science is to explain how things work, and we often refer to a compelling explanation as a good story. Scientific stories almost always blend results with speculation, but they should be clear about the strength of evidence and the resulting state of knowledge. My fear that failure to do so helps erode public confidence in science is what leads me to say that rejection of science is partly a failure of narrative.
Why does this failure of narrative happen?
It occurs in part because of the pressures faced by scientists to tell compelling stories, and it seems to be a relatively new phenomenon. Compare, for example, a different case that was discussed by one of the great epidemiologists of the 20th century, Sir Bradford Hill, when he talked about a breakthrough medical treatment for which he pointed out no randomized clinical trial was necessary. Successful treatment of tuberculous meningitis with streptomycin in just one patient was enough because the disease was otherwise invariably fatal. Recently, I went back to the 1946 paper that reported this finding. Here's how they summarized their breakthrough results, and I'm quoting. Tuberculous meningitis in a one-year-old baby was treated with intramuscular and intrathecal streptomycin with what would appear to be favorable modification of the disease. That kind of cautious statement stands in stark contrast to the promotion and often over-promotion of ideas we see today, which appear to result in part from an excessive drive for accolades and financial support in today's university-based research environments. But it also occurs because the relevant audiences are not sufficiently knowledgeable about or attentive to reasoning from data. In my lecture, I focused on the role of reasoning from data and statistical thinking in scientific narrative.
In the lecture, you review a few major concepts such as variation, models, uncertainty, protocols, and ambiguity, and you illustrate them with interesting examples. Could you just briefly summarize here?
Well, the first example I used was a very famous study that involved a very famous set of documents. The study was published as a book in 1964. Its subject was The Federalist, a collection of essays written to argue in favor of adoption of the U.S. Constitution. And the Federalist Papers were, and remain today, an important set of documents in the history of government. There were 85 essays or papers, each written anonymously by one or more of Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. Before 1964, the author of each paper was known for most of the papers, but there were 12 for which the authorship was disputed. It was either Hamilton or Madison. But it was not known which one of them wrote those papers. Mosteller and Wallace introduced statistical models to describe the rate at which particular words were used by Hamilton and by Madison among the papers of known authorship. Then, based on those statistical models fitted to the known authorship data, They computed the probability that Madison was the author for each of the 12 disputed papers. Their results were dramatic, and the Mosteller and Wallace study was an important contribution to history and to statistics. In this case, there was variation in word usage across different papers and by the two authors. The statistical model involved probability distributions that described the variation in word usage, and then Mosteller and Wallace quantified their uncertainty using their statistical model. The next concept I talked about in the lecture involved the notion that I refer to as protocols. I illustrated this with the so-called Bible code. The idea in the Bible code was that if you skip letters in the Bible and you look at every second letter or every third letter or every fourth letter and so on from some starting point, you can get patterns that spell out words. Some people consider this more than a coincidence, and instead, they think of it as a deliberately hidden message of divine origin. As you can imagine, when powerful computing became widely available, people could write programs to search for such patterns. Three Israeli mathematicians did this, and in 1994, their results were published in the journal Statistical Science. By this method, they reported finding names and birthdates of famous rabbis in close proximity, that is, the name and the birthdate were close to each other in their patterns. But these rabbis were not yet alive at the time the book of Genesis was written, and it was the book of Genesis they were studying. These mathematicians had learned enough statistics to know that patterns can arise simply by chance, so they had to evaluate how often patterns as surprising as these might arise by chance alone. When they did this, they found that such patterns were extremely rare, so the obvious conclusion was that chance alone could not have explained the patterns they found. The implication, then, was that they had found support for this idea that there are divine messages hidden in the Bible. Fortunately, this strange puzzle of how such a thing could occur was solved a few years later, and it turned out that the original authors had deviated from the protocol of their statistical test. The way they conducted the test involved some choices that may have seemed innocuous to them, but turned out to be very consequential and ultimately invalidated their results. So I go through this in much greater detail in the lecture, but I think it's a nice illustration, not only of the way seemingly surprising patterns can arise by chance, but also the importance of following strictly the protocol, that is, the specification of the method, in this case, the protocol that defined the statistical test.
What about ambiguity? What do you mean by that?
So I use ambiguity to refer to vague concepts that can be made precise in more than one way. So one of the first things that statistics students are exposed to is the distinction between median and mean. For example, in 2010, the median household income in Pittsburgh was $42,000, but the mean was $65,000. Now, in basic statistics, median and mean are often presented mainly to discuss what's usually called central tendency. But it also illustrates the deep and important point that a vague general idea can be made precise in different ways. One place where this comes up is in the most important method in statistics, regression. In the simplest case of regression, we usually say we're examining the relationship of a variable y to a variable x. Now, with a pair of variables, x and y, nearly everyone, at least nearly every scientist, seems to remember that correlation does not imply causation. But when we introduce an additional variable, say w, a remarkable thing happens, and it makes them seem to forget this distinction between correlation and causation. In common verbiage, regression examines the relationship of y to x while controlling for w, or for emphasis, people might say, regression examines the relationship of y to x even after controlling for w. This is very useful. There are tons of examples of interesting scientific applications of regression, where the relationship of one variable to another is examined while controlling for a third variable, or even many additional variables. But it's very treacherous. It's easy to misconstrue measured variables as perfect representations of ambiguous concepts, and this seems to lull investigators into forgetting that crucial distinction between correlation and causality. Especially troublesome are applications involving socioeconomic status, or SES. SES is defined differently in different studies, but it always is, in practice, some composite variable based on things that are supposed to measure what we think of as socioeconomic status, such as income or educational attainment or some ranking of occupations. Ambiguity is always lurking in regression analysis using SES. For example, in some study, it could be that it's not income that matters, but rather wealth, the total amount of property and money that a family has, that actually determines in some way the phenomenon being discovered. But wealth itself is rarely measured. And really, that's just one possibility of what we might mean when we say socioeconomic status. When I searched for the phrase, even after controlling for socioeconomic status, I found the following three examples. First, and I'm quoting, students with high fitness scored significantly better on math and social studies tests compared with less fit students, even after controlling for SES. Here's the second example, and I'm quoting again. Even after controlling for SES, students wearing more formal clothing showed stronger inclinations toward abstract processing. And here's the third example. Once students begin school, the black-white test score gap grows, even after controlling for SES. My point was, in the lecture, we should regard all of these statements with skepticism.
In your lecture, you also talk about scientific method. How does that tie in?
Well, one thing I realized in preparing the lecture is that we in the scientific and educational community need to promote a clear, contemporary vision of what science is. That this is one of the things that's missing, that some of these misrepresentations of results amount to blurring the public's notion of what science is really about. The contemporary vision we need would replace the outdated description of scientific method that's often labeled hypothetico-deductive. So, for example, if you look up scientific method in the Oxford English Dictionary, you'll find a serviceable description, and it references Bacon and Descartes. Bacon and Descartes are 17th century philosophers. But we don't teach 17th century calculus. Undergraduates learn 19th century calculus. Statistics graduate students learn 20th century calculus because there's been progress over the last several hundred years. And the same is true about our understanding of the scientific method. So, importantly, what we want to reaffirm to the public is that science has a very special status among all the subjects of narrative conversation due to the scientific method. And here's my concise statement, and this is really just a first draft of what I think we ought to be saying the scientific method is. The scientific method aims to provide explanatory models and theories by collecting and analyzing data according to protocols so that the data provide information about models, replication is possible, and the models become increasingly accurate. Through my discussion of examples in the lecture, I tried to emphasize the explanatory role of models, their relationship to data, the importance of protocols, which again refers to the specification of methods in sufficient detail that others can do the same thing, and the use of data to provide information about models. I'm not suggesting this is fundamentally different than the traditional view of science, but its emphasis is definitely different, and I think it's much more in line with contemporary science.
Rob, you end the lecture by discussing the need for better education in understanding reports about science.
That's right. The big points I tried to make are that science and the world as a whole would function better if constraints on narrative were informed by basic teachings of statistics. And of course, the scientific community should insist on greater clarity and restraint in discussing results, and in public should self-consciously promote an accurate view of science. But we have to admit, this requires literate audiences. For an appreciation of science in the modern world, it is imperative that we educate our citizenry about the topics that I touched on in my lecture, which is to say we must educate them in statistical thinking and its fundamental role in defining the scientific method.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.